kung fu kick you in the dick. Old man Wade ain't nothing to fuck with. Old man Wade might stomp a cunt quick. Don't call old man Wade a punk bitch, cause he'll kung fu kick you in the dick.
Congratulations, old man Wade, for you are victorious by way of swift kick to the dick.
And welcome to the Old Man Wade Show. I am your host, the God of Stubborn and Lord of Laughter, the Bieber slang, Old Man Wade. And I'm sitting here with a man I admire, a man I've been listening to for about 5 years. Guy got me into whiskey. State your name, tell everyone who you are.
I'm Slade Ham.
That's all you got, man?
That's it. I do so many things. I gave up on the label a long time ago. I'm a person who does things, and occasionally I've tricked people into giving me money for them.
Why'd you give up on it? I like the dragon slaying Jedi ninja. It's the book. The book is called, like, you know what,
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, it's Until All the Dragons Are Dead, and it was a stretch of my life. And I think that defined me during that stretch. I'll get long-winded on all of this. I've become so fascinated with these, with memories and with the eras that we've lived through, and I sort of accept when I've put a cap on one era and I'm off into some different stuff. And that really kind of defined me for this last decade. And now I'm like, I don't know what I am right now. Figuring it out.
So that brings up a whole nother question, because you are a world traveler. Like, you do tours for you do comedy for the military. Correct me if I'm wrong. You started doing the cruises now.
Yes, the travel certainly defines this era of me. I think it's important to who I am now. I do a lot of the military stuff. I'm going back out to. Where are we going? Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait in May, which is a lovely time to visit the Middle East. It's just hot, but it's a good cause. So I'll be back out there, and then I'll pick up some contracts with Carnival Cruise Lines, and I weirdly swore that would never be a thing I did, and then some friends of mine who also work for Carnival, Billy D. Washington specifically, some guys I just really, really, really respect, J.R. Brow. Some of these comics are doing some work for them out there, and they go, bro, it's not what you think it is. These are crowds of 400 people a show, and they're there to laugh, and it's real grown up shit. And you got to do one, you know, I got to do one show for the family, but whatever. It's kind of fun. It's actually remarkably fun to have teenagers or younger kids in the crowd, just because it makes you work different muscles. But the bigger part of it was getting to get out there, and they're not crappy shows. They're fun. And I get to pick up some additional countries and Caribbean travel, and, you know, I get to dive.
So how do you get around the squirting joke when you're talking to, like, teenagers?
You don't get around it. You go around it. it's a weird thing. So I have a couple of layers to my show, and I guess it depends on the environment and the crowd and how I'm feeling, and a million other variables as to which layer happens. But sometimes working perfectly clean is really, really fun. And the reason is because the other two possible tiers being the other end of the spectrum, which is super, super filthy, which is really, really easy. It's honestly the simplest comedy I think you can do. I like to stay most of the time somewhere in between those two. I like to be intelligent. I like to tell stories, but I like the liberty of punctuating it with the word fuck. You should have all of the tools at your disposal, no matter what you're creating. You should have all of them, and you should be able to pick from them. The kid shows. Sorry, I can't call them a kid show. The shows where there might be kids. Kids are remarkably easy to trick. They listen to everything. They'll correct you if you misstep in a joke. If you say, for instance, if I'm doing a bit about one of my nieces, and in one vignette, the niece is 9, and then later on I refer to as being 10, one of the a kid in the crowd will interrupt you and go, "I thought you said she was 9. It makes you be a little bit more aware. And they're having fun, so you're always constantly trying to flex muscles that you don't normally get to flex because they're children and they respond differently and they get different references, and you can even do references that they don't get and sort of lean into the comedy of them not getting it and why they don't get it. It's really kind of a fun direction to have taken. Makes me stay a little bit more aware.
So you brought up a topic that's been it's been kind of weird that it's been popping up a lot in my life over the last we'll say about a couple of years. Kids. And like, I know for you, you're probably on the same page I am. Like, you know, you're sans kids. You don't want kids. That's not something that you want to do.
I don't want to interrupt you before you get to the question. But it is there are statements that me 12 years ago made that I don't know that this me should have to live up to. I was a little bit more anti, and I'm still against, you know, I know my lifestyle. They don't fit my lifestyle. You can't go do what I do, travel the way I travel, make the things I'm making, and still raise a kid in a way that makes sense to me. So I push it off to the side because the other things I'm making seem more important than dumping another human being out into the world. That doesn't seem like where I bring value to the planet.
So okay, you know, you kind of answered the question that everything I was going to ask, because date number one with my now wife, she goes, before we go any further, she goes, "Do you want kids?" I go, "Absolutely not." She goes, "Good, me neither." So our whole relationship, which is going on 12 years, we didn't want kids. We still don't want kids. I got my vasectomy last year, and like, so I'm at this new gig now, and everyone's like, "Oh, don't you want a little you?" I'm like, "No." What about carrying a lineage? I'm like, "I'm good. Like, I can get up." And like, so a couple weeks ago, we had a friend of mine's birthday party, and we kind of were laughing at it on the way home. I was like, "Yeah, we could just go get shit-faced and then leave." It's fucking great. Like, it's just the little random things. Like, we were.
But I bet you guys did a reaffirmation of your stance before you got the vasectomy. Like, you go, "Hey, do we still feel the way we felt 12 years ago?" Right? And I ask that because that's what I'm starting to discover with myself, is that these different people along the way made so many of the decisions I'm still living by.
Well,
does that make sense?
It does. It absolutely does. Because, like, it was funny. Up until I got the vasectomy, every year my wife would go, which is, you'll understand this as a comic book guy and a Marvel Cinematic Universe guy, I call my wife Valkyrie. She's my Valkyrie. And okay. So when we went to Hawaii, it was like, it was a definite time, because it was like, holy shit, we could do this once a year if we wanted to. Because we don't have to worry about paying for our kids to go to fucking college. We don't have to worry about getting a babysitter. We don't have to worry about any of this shit. We can just get up and go. Like, you know what I mean? And so for us, and like, and you might laugh at this. My dad said to me, "It's not up to you. It's up to the grandparents to decide where you have kids." And my, and I'm on speaker. And my wife goes, "What, so you cannot see your grandkids too?"
Oh my God.
And, yeah, and that's why I love my wife, because she's just about as fucking smart ass as I am. And I laughed my ass off. My dad was like, "What'd you say?" I was like, "Nothing. Don't worry about it." and just kind of left it alone. But like, so, but people are under the assumption that when you have like you're a single man and you enjoy your life, you take the pictures, you go all over the world, and people make the assumption that like it's a lonely life. And I always point to them. I go, "You think it's lonely? I was like, do me a favor, go to Slade Ham's Instagram, and you'll see it's not a lonely life. It's actually the exact opposite."
There's multifacets to what I want to say here. One, there is the perception that life is lonely. It is often said by people who have no other way to justify it. They have to believe that there is a trade-off, or it's just downright unfair. You shouldn't be allowed to have all of that and be happy. So they have to convince themselves that there's some underlying unhappiness to what I do. That is utterly untrue. There was a point where I think being single might have bothered me. In the midst of all of this, there was a relationship. I was not public or loud about it at all. In 2014.
Really?
She has said she's moved on. She's married. She's decided that the best contribution is a child. She fell into that trap, and she lives in Australia, and that's her life. I truthfully pull for the wildfires. I just don't care what happens.
Wait, is this the crazy one?
No, not at all.
Okay.
No. In fact, it was a remarkable relationship. It was exactly the kind of relationship that if you're going to do what I do, it's the only way it works. She did registered massage therapy. She did the physical therapy stuff for the Raptors, and she worked in Toronto. And she was Canadian. She was a yoga instructor, and she checked a lot of boxes. And we flew around the world, and we went to Costa Rica, and we went to Quebec City, and we went to the Smoky Mountains, and we went to New Orleans, and it was a wonderful life. And we shot whiskey, and we had amazing. It was incredible. At some point, though, the natural progression of things, it encroached on my space. There was a point where she wanted to come to Houston. And she wanted, I mean, the reality was she was going to end up living with me. And it was not a situation I was ready to get back into. And you put me in a corner and you go, it's this or this. I'm always going to let you go do whatever that thing is. I just don't do ultimatums. So anyway, Australia can burn. I went right back to finding out, some self-discovery that comes with getting out of a situation like that. You go, okay, am I upset? What am I upset about? Am I upset that I'm no longer in a relationship? Am I upset specifically over this girl? What is really bothering me here? And with a little bit of introspection and some meditation and some self-work, you find out that nothing's missing. You're like, this is actually the difference between rejection and liberation is literally vantage point.
The name of this episode might be the difference between what you just said. Sorry. I've been drinking, so.
say that again?
I was gonna quote you, but I've been drinking, so.
Yeah, no worries. I've never said it before, so I'd have to listen back myself. But the gist of it is that I what I thought was this horrible loss, when I look back at it, I mean, she's married, she's raising a kid, she might have more than one now, I don't know. She's stuck in that life, and I'm still, I'm on pace to go to 20 different countries this year. So
Jesus.
The trade-off to me is, for whatever I lost in that, I lost someone who was just going to make babies for a living. That's not what moves my needle. If I'm going to share the planet with somebody and this entire experience, whatever it is, I at least want to do it with somebody with some ambition. And it's not to say people with kids don't have ambition, but usually that ends up being the end of ambition, at least for a while.
And it's funny because a lot of people will hear that, and unfortunately they'll hear the only part of it is, oh, well, but you're still single. It's like, that single doesn't mean lonely.
Lonely is the product of, I know people in relationships that are lonelier than I could ever imagine being. As a stand-up comic, it sounds, and I don't know if you and I have spoken of this before, it sounds weird for me to say that I am an introvert.
Really?
But I am.
Knowing, like, hearing stuff that you do, like, it kind of does make sense, because like you've said on the show, you go to the coffee shop, like, you know, you kind of go to coffee shop on your own. You go on a motorcycle trips on your own. So it does make sense.
I go eat lunch on my own. I go, for me, and I don't, make no mistake, I enjoy every single moment of live performance. And I enjoy, to an extent, every handshake and conversation afterwards. And there comes a point where I just go, okay, I'm faking it now. It's an immense drain on me physically and I guess emotionally. I just, being entertaining and around people, I'm just like, I just don't want to do it. When I'm on stage, stand up weirdly might be the loneliest medium you could ever work in. There's no, for whatever the perception is, that it's you in front of 1,000 people or 400 people or whatever, it's you by yourself and then them as a collective. It's a very isolated medium. And I enjoy that. I enjoy the comfort of being by myself. I enjoy being self-reliant. I enjoy not having to answer to anyone or ask anyone permission, or that's just kind of how I live my life. So when I come home at the end of a road trip, at the end of something, cracking open the door and not being in a relationship, being able to walk into that house and it be silent, man, and I can just turn the shower on hot and I don't even have to shut the door. And I can turn whatever my music on at 2:30 in the morning because that's when I got home and I'm in the mood to hear some punk. And I can just hit play and Google just fires it out of the speakers. And I take that hot shower and I shove my suitcase into the middle of the living room and I flop down on the couch after that shower and I play PlayStation until 3:30 in the morning. And I wake up the next day and I get right back to the business of making stuff and doing things. And it's the whole series of businesses I own and all that stuff that's important to me. But that freedom to come home and do that and not have to answer. And I know there are people screaming at their phones right now going, well, my relationship's not like that. I can do whatever I want. I know there are outliers. And I know the outliers believe they're the majority. But they're not. They're just not.
Well, those are the irrational people. For example, I love my wife. I love my wife to death. Do you know what I can do? I can't walk around jacking my dick off from fucking bathroom to, like, bedroom. Because, like, you know what I mean? There are rules. There's rules to this shit. Like, you know what I mean?
And as there are any time there is more than one human being occupying a physical space. That's why we have laws. It's what we do as humans. We get into more than one of us in a space. And we have to lay out the rules of engagement. And I just don't like being in places that have those rules. And it's not because they're bad. They're amazing. I just function better in a place where those things don't exist.
And again, I think that's the point to it is it's like people just don't understand it. But like I kind of get it. Like for me, it's not for me. Like I'm good. But I see other people, like there's a bartender that I know, I call him the world's greatest. He's happy as fuck. This woman called him a machine. He'd get up at like 5 o'clock, he'd go to the gym, he'd go get breakfast, he'd work, then like he'd like go open up the bar, he'd work the bar from like noon to 2 a.m., and he'd go fuck like some random like patron and do it all over again. And I'm like, and I'd ask him, like, yo, how the fuck do you do that? He goes, I live life.
Honest to God, when you get to a point where, for me, they always talk about it's very cliche that once you get out of a relationship, you got to take some time to find yourself. You got to spend some time getting to know you, not needing anybody. All that cliche bullshit. But it's very real. I spent so much time with myself. Getting good at being with myself, getting good at not being lonely, but at not acknowledging the absence of another person as being a bad thing. It's to sort of just open my eyes to the experience humanly. At what is it like living like this and realizing that the things we're trained to be afraid of aren't real things at all. And once you get good enough at that, it really, really requires something incredibly unique to interrupt that pattern. Why would I break something that's working tremendously for me?
Makes sense to me. Alright, so enough of that shit. So I'm going to get into something that I call the Boomer Chronicles. I'm going to bring up some stuff.
The what?
The Boomer Chronicles. Okay. I am Old Man Wade. I am a boomer, so I'm going with the, I'm calling it the Boomer Chronicles.
Okay.
So some of these things, you're probably just going to look at me and go, you're probably going to go, what the fuck is he babbling about? Some stuff you may comment on. So first off, I'll ask you, who wins in a fight between Kratos and Dante from Devil May Cry?
I am just a Kratos fan. I personally believe he is invincible, and I hang my hat on that.
All right, so you're with me. My best friend, Lavelle Diddy, he always goes Dante. I go, I'm going Kratos. So, hey Diddy, you're down 2-1. you know Missy Elliott. I bet Missy Elliott has the best sex, one of the best sexes of all time.
Man, that ass. I'm gonna ding positive. All
right. So Donald Duck is my spirit animal. I just want to throw that out there. I love me some Donald Duck. Ever since I was a kid, the anger, the random like swindling with the quarter and with the string attached to it. Love me some fucking Donald Duck, man. I also want to say I hate seeing kids running 100 yards away from their parents, especially in the streets. When your kid gets hit by a car, I'm going to laugh and walk over them. If your kids get kidnapped, that's your own fucking fault. There's nothing I can do about that, man. All right, so let's get into the dork shit. This is what I have been dying to talk to you about. So before we get into the big thing, which is Star Wars, I want to talk about the Joker.
Yes.
So before we get into it, what did you think of the movie? Not Joaquin Phoenix's performance. What did you think about the actual movie?
Thoroughly enjoyed the entire movie. His performance, we can get into in a moment. But I absolutely thought it was a fantastic film.
So the reason I bring this on, because I know you enjoyed the movie. Me personally, I was bored to tears for the first 45 minutes.
Absolutely understandable.
And whenever I talked to somebody about the movie before it came out, I said, oh, Joaquin Phoenix is going to be amazing. Like, there's no doubt in my mind. And I joked with a buddy of mine that Joaquin Phoenix could play Rosa Parks and no one would care.
He's that good of an actor.
Yeah.
He is certainly in that upper echelon. His performance, it's hard to say if that film would have worked without his performance. I don't believe it would have. I believe that they are hand in hand responsible for one another. That script, it took me a minute. It was the second time I watched it where I had to pull myself out of a couple of things. One, this being a essentially DC movie, even though it's kind of operating in a sort of what-if capacity or alternate timeline sort of capacity, it is still a DC movie. And with that comes a certain, anytime I'm going to see a comic book movie, I just have a certain set of expectations. And none of those expectations involve it being slow.
Yes.
So that was a big thing for me to swallow. And I also don't tend to like slow movies. But the few that I can remember that I really enjoyed, movies like The Wrestler, also with a fantastic lead character. They were these weird, once you realize you're watching the degeneration of a character, you're watching them literally crumble in front of your eyes, and you sort of, when you know the outcome also, you know there's a snapping point for Arthur Fleck. You know it's coming. It's unquestionable. You don't know where, you don't know when, but you know it's coming. So it makes all of those slow tension building moments that just really feel like they go nowhere, if you pull back far enough, you realize it's just the same build of tension through the whole movie. It's not, we're used to scenes where it builds and breaks. They never really break it up until that. So they break it where? At the subway scene?
Probably.
When he shoots the guys. And then they spend the rest of it building all the way back up so that he can kill, you know, the coworker, and then the spoiler alert, by the way, I'm sure everyone's
it's been long enough.
For that snap scene in his kitchen with the midget, the other guy, and then on to the Murray show. And so that was a big part of it, the pacing. And I had to go, okay, I'm watching a different kind of movie. And then the other part of it was, I'm not sure exactly what I was about to say. Hang on a second. I totally drew an entire fucking blank. God, I had the point. I didn't write it down. This is my problem. I got long-winded.
I'm taking notes on my phone now. So
give me a second. It was the DC movie side of it. The other part of it was the fact that I had to surrender to there being an unreliable narrator. That was the other side of it. I realized that some of the things that took me out of the film, like the way Alfred reacted, some of these other sort of the way Thomas Wayne was portrayed in general. Once you realize you're and all of that, of course, gets brought to light that he's, you know, you've been watching this sort of bullshit narrator's point of view with the Zazie Beetz, whatever her name's, her scenes where you realize that there was no relationship, there was no interaction. It sort of rips that curtain away and it gives you permission to question everything else. And that, to me, once I was like, okay, all of the weird things that were bugging me aren't real. And this is just a slow crawl to get to this character's complete and utter snapping point. Once I framed it right, I was like, damn it, Todd Phillips did something here.
For me, it wasn't even the subway scene that got me into it. For me, it was the moment that Alfred pulled Bruce away from Arthur. It was that exact moment where I went, now I get it. And from then on, I was like, this is good. Because
you got to go back once you get the right lens on, then you got to go back and watch the movie again with that lens from the beginning. And I think it'll change the way you view that pacing.
And that's the one thing everyone has told me about it. Once I actually start watching, once I go back and go, okay, now I get it. Because you know what it is? There were also certain moments where I got really upset. When he was just trying to make this kid happy and the woman was like, don't talk to my son. I was like, you serious? Like he's trying to bring joy to the world. But then there were other scenes like the kid stealing his sign and then him like being chastised for it. It was like, this seems kind of forced. You know what I mean? So
of course, you have to build. That's the challenge of a character like that, is that you want to build in some sort of sympathetic element to the character. It's hard to have a protagonist who is just purely a horrible person from the jump. And Joaquin portrays him so perfectly in that you really kind of emotionally feel for the guy so many times, even past the point where he's committed horrible murders. Yeah. You still, when he's sitting there in that chair on the talk show, there's even moments where you're like, damn it, man, I want to hug him. You know, that's a hard thing to pull off with a character like that, and especially to people who are such diehard fans of the character, because you don't want to let go of certain facts. You don't. You're bothered by the age difference between the character and Bruce Wayne. You're bothered by a million different little things that the comics have taught you are canon, and this kind of flies in the face of all of that. So I understand not wanting to swallow it as a movie. It can be tough.
Well, one of the things after X-Men First Class, one of the things I realized was like, all right, if you're a comic book fan, you understand that there are alternate realities. This is just an alternate reality.
That's a great example, yes.
So I was like, you know what? Go into this movie. It's an alternate reality. Just accept it. Watch the movie. Enjoy it. If you like it, you like it. If you hate it, you hate it. And for the Joker, like, I didn't hate it. And it's funny because when I heard they were doing a Joker origin, quote-unquote origin story, I was like, no one asked for this. No one wants this.
Correct.
But then as I'm watching it, I'm like, But then, like I said, around that 45-minute mark, I'm like, all right, I'm all in. Like, and it's funny because you've seen enough movies. Well, you're well-versed when it comes to movies, which we'll get into later. You probably saw a lot of the things coming. But even seeing the things coming, you're kind of like, all right, it's Joaquin Phoenix, so even if you see it coming, he's still going to get you emotionally invested in what he just does. Like, you knew Zazie Beetz they weren't lovers.
Correct.
But when you see it happen, it's like you have two actors who are just, they knew what their role was, and Zazie Beetz is like 1A, 1B.
I couldn't like her more.
And like, she's like, for me, like, in terms of hotness, she's 1A and 1B with me. So like, but like, then watching her, like, my daughter's in the other room, and he's just kind of sitting there, and I'm like, fuck.
Dude, from the standpoint of somebody who understands screenwriting, at least to a certain degree, I was able to see a lot of stuff coming, but its predictability doesn't always ruin things for me in that regard. It's like if someone tells me, if you had a piece of chalk and a giant chalkboard and you said, I'm about to draw a perfect circle, even telling me doesn't ruin the art of that perfect circle.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So that's a knowing that the ultimate snap was coming, knowing where this was ultimately headed, knowing that there was, you know, probably going to be a showdown with him and Murray, seeing some of the pieces fall into place, even then, Joaquin's performance of it and the way the story was told and the scene with the little English guy and the English midget and the other guy from work
who definitely deserved everything he got.
Of course. And you kind of felt you knew that was gonna happen because the story dictates that has to happen. This is one of the waypoints we have to go through if we're going to get here. And knowing all of that, I still, that scene in that kitchen when he stabs that guy with the scissors and then when he lets the little guy go, every moment of it was still so weirdly unpredictable despite doing exactly what it did exactly what it said it was going to do from the beginning. It fulfilled every promise. And I still was nervy through the whole thing. You just didn't know. Where had he completely snapped? Was the door locked on purpose? Was the tension there for all of that? And I watched it and made me so happy to be such a dark scene.
Yes. So before we get into the next topic that we get into, so with the Joker coming out, you know that every comic book company is going to do their best to emulate what they have with the Joker. My pick for the next Joker-esque movie would be Bullseye. And I'm not looking for a redemption story with him. I just want the origin of him just being essentially a shitbag. And I don't know if you've read Bullseye Greatest Hits, but it basically goes from him being a kid who could kill a pigeon with a yo-yo.
Right.
To, putting a toothpick in a grenade pin from like 100 yards away. To him just still being essentially a shitbag. So who would you pick for the next Marvel or DC character to portray this kind of like Joker-esque redemption kind of role?
Wow. Man, that's a damn good story. Or question, anyway. They've tackled... It's interesting to do a character that is, I guess, so anti-hero. The Joker is, I mean, that's just your sympathy comes from such a weird angle with him versus someone like a Deadpool who is, you know, obviously my favorite character in the world. A complete shitbag, but his redemption comes in the form of, you know, it comes in the form of his sense of humor and his ultimate, you know, sticking up for the little guy. And he's got a lot of redeeming qualities. So if you're going to delve into that, it's got to be a character who, you know, Bullseye's a great one. I haven't read Greatest Hits, but the way you lay it out, you go, okay, I personally want to see Lobo.
Yes.
That's really where, that's the one unfulfilled sort of anti-hero that I still pull to see on the screen. And I've heard that they've done some version of that, maybe in a TV thing. I'm not even sure. I would just like to see, because it's so outside of the box. It's so far. It gives you an environment to play in that DC's never really touched. It gives you a character that is unlike anything they've ever really done on screen yet, specifically DC.
And what is it like? His story is just like even the gods don't want him.
Right. And he's just this attitude that I think is kind of missing in a lot of characters right now. Like you got it with Wolverine, but he was played so. It's hard for what's his name? I'm drawing a complete blank on the actor played Wolverine.
Hugh Jackman.
Hugh Jackman. It's hard for me to buy grit coming from Hugh Jackman. He's just too. Every time he starts to growl, I hear him do Oklahoma. And I just kind of. And it's not a slight to his range because he is believable in both. But he's only so good as Wolverine, and I feel like there's that sort of character, the really bitey, grudgy, cigar hanging out of the mouth, grunty kind of Lobo Wolverine character, is just underserved right now.
You know, and so a buddy of mine said it best, and he said, Hugh Jackman is too good of an actor to only be okay as Wolverine.
Yes, yes, that is a fantastic way to put it. I think he was as good as anybody could have done Wolverine at the time in that particular, for what those films were going to be. I don't think there was room for the Wolverine I wanted. I think he was really, really, really good at it in Logan, though.
I think that Logan is one of the two or three best comic book movies that I've ever seen. Because it was like, okay, so you want R-rated Wolverine? You got it. And it was everything that I wanted. And one of my favorite scenes, and the best way I can describe it is, it was after he buried Xavier, and he's just kicking the shit out of this truck. He's pissed off, and he's just angry. But like, there's a part of Logan and Wolverine that people don't recognize. Like, he's actually a really sentimental and emotional person. And then watching him try to drive this, and after that, try to drive the truck and falling asleep, and then and then Laura switching over and like driving for him, it was like, you guys could have done 20 years of this if you weren't cowards.
But I don't know that they could have. It was, you end up in these weird circular, what created what, how did, because. You couldn't have just come out of the chute with Wolverine.
That's true.
I mean, look at what they tried to do. They did. They tried. That Logan film was not the first solo Wolverine movie. There's a track record of shit movies. So they just got it right finally. And the reason they got it right was they stopped letting him be the character. He needed to be that character for those X-Men movies. X-Men movies weren't gritty Wolverine movies. The Wolverine movies weren't gritty Wolverine movies. They all were right in the vein of that sort of, hey, we've never seen superheroes. Everybody's got on leather. They were that. And it was cool because we'd never seen it before. But that was the Wolverine we got. They finally took that character and went, okay, we're going to put it so far in the future, we don't have to play by any of these rules anymore. We can be a little dark and dirty, and we can be true to the character the way he's written. And that's what we got with the old man Logan stuff. It was finally Wolverine. But you can't do that without having the other stuff come first.
Yeah, it's...
You wouldn't have bought it. You wouldn't have bought it. You would have bitched and moaned about how Hugh Jackman wasn't a good enough Wolverine. And the only reason we knew he could pull it off was because he was an okay Wolverine for 5 other films.
Good sir, I am a nerd, and I am a comic book fan, and I'm a comic book writer, and I am a paid writer of comic books. I would never, in my journalistic integrity, ever besmirch the name of Hugh Jackman or the Deadpool. Not Deadpool, the Deadpool. Good sir, I would never do that. If you could, and listening audience, if you can tell, that was complete sarcasm. I liked Wolverine Origins. I hated what they did with the abomination, the Merc without a mouth.
At the end of the day, the worst, the hallmark of bad writing is you took a character's strength. His number one thing he's good at, his mouth.
He's called the Merc with the mouth.
Shut. You sewed it shut. It's almost so poetic that if it was in on its own joke, and I think that's probably why I pull for the Lobo sort of film, is that I'd love to see, because it's in on the joke. It's sort of the way I watched The Witcher. It's in on the joke. Lobo was designed a bit as a parody of guys like Wolverine and Punisher. That's like that's what he originally started out as. And I forget who drew him. Was it Geffen? Keith? I can't remember the dude's name. Nevertheless, and then it caught on because people are just dumb. It's kind of the same way Republicans and Democrats both watched the Colbert Report and thought it was about the other side. Sometimes people are fooled by the thing you thought, by the card you thought you were playing face up. You're like, I thought you guys all were in on the, wow, oh no, it's War of the Worlds. Y'all bought that? That's what we didn't think in a million years. Anyone was going to take that
seriously. Oh God, okay. Yes.
And that happened. That's what sort of happened with Lobo. That's why I think it would be a cool sort of thumb in the eye.
Oh God, a Lobo movie would be so damn good. Because again, like you said, it's pretty much, it would be a giant fuck you to everybody.
It would be a bit of a. It would thumb its nose at everything from Marvel to DC. I mean, everybody that's been putting out movies lately, it's just kind of, it would kind of give you a film that goes. It's exactly what Deadpool was, where the fourth wall. Yeah, he breaks the fourth wall, but Lobo's just more parody. You're like, I know what I'm watching. I know exactly what this is. There's no way guns hold that many bullets. I'm fully aware. Physics don't apply here because we're having fun.
I don't know if you've ever read Injustice, but before we get to the Star Wars topic, one of my favorite Lobo moments was, it came from Injustice 2. And someone ripped the bottom half of his torso off, like, so with no legs. And it gave him a Green Lantern ring. Yeah, you're already laughing. And so one of the first things he did was create a giant green dick and hit somebody with it. And then, I think he kicked Atrocitus's cat, and then it was just Atrocitus going, "I'm powered by something that gives me rage, and you kicked my cat." And all I could think, and it was like, "Oh, this is the greatest thing ever," because Lobo is—he's just that asshole. He just does not give a fuck. And I absolutely love it.
I think that's what, just as a people, I think we might find refreshing right now. We're too caught up in the what we should do and what we shouldn't do and what can we do this and is this allowed and it's blah 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 blah. And sometimes it's just nice to see. So I mean, it's why we all watched wrestling as kids when Stone Cold would crack beers together and use words like hell and damn on TV, and we all
which they can't do anymore.
We thought it was the greatest thing in the entire world. Why? Because he was breaking the rules. He didn't give a shit.
So, all right. So, this is what I want to talk to you about. You are, like, as I said, a Jedi slang. You are a Star Wars fan. You are an admitted Star Wars fan. So, I have a Boomer Report for you.
Oh, I'm in.
So, first off, we got worst Star Wars character.
Okay.
So,
go ahead.
No, dude. I want to know, who do you think is the worst Star Wars character?
it's I don't want to be the guy who just says Jar Jar, but God damn it, Jar Jar. And here's why. I don't like, and we're gonna get to this. We're gonna get to this when we get to the new trilogy. I don't like people who don't stick to the plan, and I don't believe I've seen all of the conspiracy theories about Jar Jar being, you know, the big baddie that was supposed to show up in parts 2 and 3, and the bumbling fool. It was, and if you really go back and watch the Phantom Menace with those eyes, you can see it, and it's bolstered by the fact that it wouldn't be the first time Lucas had done that.
Yeah.
I apologize for the train if that's coming over the phone. But it would not be the first time it'd done that. It was Yoda originally. The harmless, bumbling character is suddenly the powerful master. So if that had been the plan, and if they had stuck that through, I might not feel this way. But if that wasn't the plan, then I can't think of a more useless, unnecessary character. Because as someone who understands screenwriting, nothing happens. Nothing happens. It's Chekhov's gun. If you show me a gun, somebody better use the gun. They're just very basic tenets of film. And Jar Jar serves none. You can't even chalk it up as just comedic relief. It moves the story none at all. And that's my problem with him. He's comically bad. He's a cartoon. He's poorly voiced. Everything about him is annoying. But mainly, he just gets in the way.
So, yeah, I...
That and the digital-sized noodles that they crammed back into the re-releases of Return of the Jedi. Because that was absolutely embarrassing.
You know what? The only thing I'm shocked that Jarda didn't do was go, "Hello, well, hello there." And I'm like, okay, we get what you're doing, dude.
It was full-blown. Mammy said, "I could have..." And you just, head down. And I know that the guy who voiced it is, you know, he's made his statements. It's just bad. It's just not a good character. It's not entertaining. It's not well done. It's slapstick from the 30s, and it's a bit racy. And I just don't care for it. But I really just don't like the fact that he was unnecessary to the story. I felt like there was story written around him, and that took me out of it. Why are we doing all this underwater shit?
So yeah, it was. And again, like, I'm assuming you're a Tom and Jerry fan.
Oh yeah.
Tom and Jerry can be good. It can be slapstick, can be funny, but he was just bad.
Mm-hmm. It was not entertaining to me when I watched it the first time. I've watched it multiple times on repeat. And I think, you know, it's the kid who played Anakin could be my second argument for worst Star Wars characters, except he's a vital part of the rest of the trilogy of trilogies, but he's the kid who played him is god awful.
So, who is the most overrated?
Boba Fett.
Okay, so I'm gonna say this. I wholeheartedly agree, and this is a part of me where someone goes, "Well, you need to read the books," and I'm like, "No, you don't."
Star Wars is, and I am a fan of Clone Wars. I loved every season of it. I'm excited that they're gonna put a bow on some of that. But to me, Star Wars is still really the 9 movies that I saw with my real eyes. It's all of the side projects and all of the Mandalorian now is so part of it's one of the, we can talk about that in a minute, but it's fantastic. I just mainly Boba Fett is 2 scenes worth of film. That's it. He's standing there when they drop Han into the Carbonite, and he's there for the battle on Jabba's barge. And that's it.
Yeah, my thing about it is, my thing has always been, is like, if you're going to, if someone goes, well, the comic book, I'm like, no. The source material comes from the movies. It's not like when someone goes, well, check the source material for Deadpool. I'm like, I am. Deadpool's source material is the comic books. The X-Men source material is the comic books. Boba Fett's source material are the movies.
Yes, you're simply left with what your eyes could see. You can tell me all the additional stories you want to with the character, but you're ultimately whatever you were when you came out. And you're right, Deadpool was a comic book character. There's a wealth of comic books that you can read. That's where most of Deadpool exists. And then also, here's these two films we made about him. But yeah. Boba Fett is known for being... They made the action figure after that character in Empire Strikes Back. That scene where he has a line, that's all of that. That was the impact of what is Boba Fett. Even though there's more and there's been additional stuff, it's not really... It's just fan fiction. If you paint it with a brush of canon or not. Nobody cares. Nobody cares about a Star Wars comic book. They did all those. They want you to. But nobody cares about a Star Trek comic book. There's a whole. I'm a giant Trekkie too. Nobody could have been more excited about Picard coming out. You know what? I haven't read the prequel comic books that they wrote and did leading up to it. I could not care less because Picard's not a comic book character.
Let me tell you, I really, really, really wish my co-host and brother-in-arms, Super Bowl Kavi, was here for this because he's a Star Trek guy. He loves Star Trek. He specifically got the streaming service so he could watch Picard. Like, he is like Trekkie from beginning to end.
Oh, is he not happy right now?
I don't know. We haven't talked about it yet. That's not something we've talked about yet, but I really, because I'm pretty sure that his opinions, he'll go in. Whether he loves it or likes it, and we'll talk about it. But that's another topic. But going back to the whole Boba Fett thing, it kind of annoyed me because it's like, he didn't do anything at all. You know what I mean? He kind of showed up.
Nothing.
He showed up, and then showed up again, and...
Best dressed, bro. He just was best dressed. We all wanted to be him as a kid. None of us knew why.
And we
just looked badass.
And we can get to the jokes about him falling into Gwyneth Paltrow's vagina and all the
Of course.
But like he didn't do anything like significant. But like, so you talk about the comic books, and I haven't read. I'm getting into the Star Wars comic books that Marvel's done. And one of the things I loved is, like, they did, they've been doing this thing where it's, like, in between the movies. And it was after Darth Vader fell on one of the planets. And he was like, oh, you're surrounded. And he goes, to the effect, he goes, I'm surrounded by dead men. I'm like, oh, shit. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And it's like, oh, you forget, this is Darth fucking Vader. One of the baddest fucking antagonists in the fucking world.
Dude, it was the only moments I ever questioned, like, and I still, where Star Wars poorly executed things for me, in many ways. But the first way, I don't believe that there's a part of me that doesn't believe that the kid who played Anakin in The Phantom Menace, and the Hayden Christensen who played Anakin in parts 2 and 3. I don't believe, and then after however many seasons of The Clone Wars that I've watched, which paint a thoroughly more bright version of Anakin, and these all take place between episodes 2 and 3, but it's a lot of his story with Obi-Wan, and they bring in Ahsoka Tano, who is his Padawan, and they introduce some wonderful characters, and they really give a lot of context to the clones, and it's a really well-done series, and it is canon. So when you give me that kid that was in that first trash fire. And then you give me two other episodes of Anakin, and then you give me all those seasons of the Clone Wars. I don't ever believe that that is the same character who is under the helmet of Darth Vader. Never once. Never once do I look at Darth Vader and see the Anakin that the Star Wars universe presented to me.
So what happened? So
poor execution. There's very little. If you watch episode 3, outside of a few deep stares, I guess, on the part of... But when they execute Order 66, I don't buy it. I just, no part of me views him as evil. Even in the fight with Obi-Wan, I just don't, even though I get that that's a guy who doesn't like Obi-Wan, I'm just like, that's Anakin and him and Obi-Wan are fighting. I still don't, even as he is burning on the shoreline of lava, do I go, yeah, he's going to end up in that Vader outfit. And then when they show me Vader at the end in the suit, I don't think of it being him. I just go, oh, and now Vader's here.
You know what's funny about that is like, even if you go back, I'm pretty sure if you went back and watched episode 4, which is really episode 1, it didn't even look like he wanted to get that final stroke. It kind of looked like he expected him to block.
A little bit, but again, it's a... This is my problem with Star Wars. I don't think that the reason I think and this is going to take the long way around. The reason I think the Marvel Cinematic Universe works as absolutely perfectly as it does is because I believe that Feige and whoever else is in his camp, they sit down at the beginning of each phase and they go, "This is what we're going to do." And then they spend the next however many couple of years doing that thing. Not waiting to see what the fans are going to say, waiting to hear what the focus groups think. They just execute this phase the way they planned it. And because of that, you have very, very few. If you think of it in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, however many, 20, is it 20, 22 films?
Somewhere around that.
Some large number over a decade. The amount of continuity errors and the amount of contradictions, and this is in a universe that brought time travel into the mix, and it's the missteps are tiny, tiny. And then you have Star Wars that feels like every episode was written after they found out what the audience thought of the previous episode. I feel like everything they do is reactionary. And that's what even with as good as the first trilogy, the original trilogy is, and I hang my hat on it. It's my favorite. But I feel like episode 4 was made, and then Empire Strikes Back was kind of I don't know. And again, you know, you can go back. I'm sure someone has written about this ad nauseum, but I don't know that there was a plan for Vader to be Luke's father in that first, when they first made A New Hope.
Really?
I don't think there was a play. I don't know. But my guess is that those were sort of things they went, oh shit, this worked. What can we do to make this more interesting? I think that you can see where the series has been retconned to the way Obi-Wan has been written to make some of the things he said make sense, as he talked about Vader, as he talked about Luke's father, as he, you know, spoke of them as being two different things, as he sort of talked of his own past and the Jedi's and all of that stuff. You can just see how everything was sort of written to fit all of that after the fact. And why would Luke and Leia ever kiss? It's you could say they didn't, you know, well, we wrote it because we didn't. You know, they didn't know they were brother and sister. Well, damn it, you did. Why are you writing an incest movie instead?
So you bring up, like, the original trilogy, and that's also something I wanted to bring up. Do you think the original trilogy is generational? Because for me, I saw the original trilogy when I was young. Forgot that I saw it. Watched it again in my early 30s, and I was like, oh, I get why this was so popular and why it was so iconic, because no one was doing this at this time. But looking back at it now, as you said, there wasn't a real plan for no, Luke, I am your father, because you're looking at him like, yes, it's an iconic scene, but you're kind of like, it kind of seemed forced. You know what I mean?
I think Empire, again, I could be making all of this up. Someone has probably corroborated this or asked these questions or whatever else, but the...
Oh, trust me, someone on YouTube will see this and comment on it, call Obama the N-word, and go on it from there.
Yeah. I mean, it takes generally four comments before it gets there. They went into Empire knowing what they were going to do, but I don't think Star Wars was made... I don't think because it was done on such a shoestring budget. I mean, it was completely, they were making up the ways that film was made. No one had ever shot models that way. No one had ever put practical effects in action that way. They were literally creating the methodology for doing these things. And there was no sure bet that it was going to fly at all. It was I think they blew their load. I think this was let's see what happens. And then it happened. And then the world went nuts. The rest is history. And then I think you go, okay, now, man, let's figure out what the rest of this story is.
So, all right. So,
because what I can tell you beyond the shadow of a doubt, and George Lucas could look me in the face and call me a liar himself, and I would not believe it to be true, is that, that the first three movies, that 4, 5, 6, as well as 1, 2, and 3, were all part of some scrawled out notebook from George Lucas, that he had somehow figured out exactly how all of this whole story was going to work out from way back in the day. That part did not happen.
So before I ask you the next two questions, I'm going to preface it with my answers. Preface it with a couple things. One, I have not seen the most recent Star Wars movie yet. It's been busy.
Okay.
I want to see it, and I didn't hate the last trilogy as much as everyone else did. But I will say this, and I'm going to ask you ask you a question after I say this. For me, Rogue One, I think, was the best Star Wars movie that they've done. So to you, what is the best Star Wars movie that we've seen that's been out so far?
I got to default to what is probably the most common answer, and that's Empire Strikes Back. I think that is the, and for some of the reasons we mentioned earlier, I think that's the first film where they went, okay, people are going to, this matters. I think Star Wars was made with a little bit of a, we're going to give it hell, but realistically, who knows? Empire had an audience, and I think there was a lot of pressure there to make a good film, and I think they made a great film. It's very, very infrequent that a movie ends on such a low note and is still that damn good of a movie. They created places. Hoth, my God, what they did with the AT-ATs and the AT-ATs and the snow and I'd never, child me had never seen anything like that. And even to this day, even though the special effects don't hold up, man, that is just something to take in. So I think that is the best film they've ever made. I think Rogue One was incredible in its own right, just because it was really cool for two reasons. One, to see a Star Wars war movie. I felt like it had the dirt on it that I wanted to see. It was a war movie. But two, it was the realization that we all had at some point in that film that nobody was making it out of there. And that, to me, was just, I kind of sat down a little lower in my seat. The stakes were higher. I was like, I know everything everybody's doing is about to get them killed, because there's no way out of here. And also, we don't hear about these characters ever again. So, clearly, they all die.
Go ahead.
That made it a great film.
So, it's funny, because I'm not a big war film guy, but as you say it, I'm like, holy shit, this whole thing was a war movie.
Completely, completely. Yes, it was, I mean, not Saving Private Ryan in space, but bro, at some point, it was, I mean, you're just watching people you care for get killed in battle, one after another. I mean, it's violent.
And maybe that's what it was. I got really emotionally invested in, like, the I am one of the Force, the Force is one with me.
Yes.
And it was like the idea of someone being so...
When he walks across that battlefield and those lasers miss him over and over and over.
Yeah. And then, like, his brother in arms, who everyone could go... I've made the joke that, like, that was his lover, but it's like, no. That was his soldier. That was his brother. That was the guy he loved. And I was just like,
side by side.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a war movie, man. There's no getting around that.
Fuck, I never noticed that. So, I'll ask you the question, but I'm going to tell you mine. So, my favorite character in the Star Wars mythos is C-3PO.
Ah.
Because he is a stubborn dickhead. So my wife would be R2-D2. I'd be like, oh no, like we shouldn't do that. And she'd be like, shut the fuck up and just do it. I'd be like, okay, R2. Like I'm aware of who I am. And like, so if things went good, I'd go, oh, you didn't know that was going to happen. And then when things went bad, I'd go, oh, fuck you. I knew that was going to happen. You know what I mean? So who was an underrated character from the Star Wars?
Underrated, legitimately, I hands down R2-D2. He is, I am a fan of, as a stand-up comedian, I am a fan of nonverbal acting. I like the fact that we all know R2-D2's personality, that he is a little rebellious. He is going to do what he thinks is right, even though you told him differently. He's nobody's punk. You just can't, as much as you want to own him and control him, he's still R2-D2. And we all know that. And he's never uttered a word. Every bit of that is nonverbal communication. You get tonality from his bleeps and blurbs. You know that is sad, but the fact that you can convey all of that with no language, it makes him such an unbelievably cool character, because we all understand him, and it's all through other people's translations of him.
And it's funny because it's got a very Silent Bob kind of like vibe to it.
Yeah.
But with R2-D2, there are no facial expressions to go with it.
They're like, so for the people that are creating him or puppeteering him or doing whatever, think of the things that you would do if you were even Yoda, who also is, I mean, one of my favorite characters ever.
He's fucking Yoda.
But Yoda is puppeteered like a humanoid puppet. His hands can open, you know, his arms can open and close to give things gravity. His eyebrows they furrow and make the same expressions we do. He can smile. He can look sad. It's all the human. You have all of that palette to work with. R2 is you get to pivot the head. You get to play with the angle at which he leans. I mean, you have a couple of choices, but none of them are what you would have dealing with any other sort of puppet. It's just a weird, you're creating a language, and they managed to do it, and it's been consistent through, you know, he's in, what, 9 of the 10 films or whatever it is?
Yeah. So, okay. So, you brought the films, and I know the last trilogy has gotten a lot of slack. I know some people have gone, and you know, it's the idiots who don't watch TV, who don't watch shows, who watch movies, who are like, oh, well, it's because it's Kylo Ren and she's not that good. I'm like, okay, and some people say because it's a woman. And then you got, it's Rey, I'm getting terrible with names, but it's like, oh, because you have a Rey who's like, and it was like, so what is, did you like the last trilogy?
I did. And I did because I was able to let go. I had to remind myself of many of the things we've talked about here, that that they didn't know what they were doing from the beginning, that they were making it up as they went along. And that's the spirit of the entirety of Star Wars. If what I think is true about the transition from Star Wars to Empire, they had no clue. Then they got their shit together and they decided to write Empire and Return of the Jedi, which is what probably happened. But if Jar Jar was supposed to be portrayed differently and Lucas got cold feet and they decided to change course, I'm sure there were alterations made between what they planned for episode two and what happened for episode two. So, and then you're left with whatever they did for episode three, making adjustments along the way. And that brings you all the way to this trilogy that is nothing but answering what came before. It was Rian Johnson's Last Jedi was trying to take the franchise in a place different than where J.J. Abrams left it. And then J.J. comes back for Rise of Skywalker, and he does his best to act like The Last Jedi never happened. It was, I mean, it's not even, and not even in a subtle way. Not even subtle. It's Rian writes in Rose, who, personally, I don't find a very engaging character. I didn't find her enjoyable in Last Jedi. I thought the big scene she was involved in was a completely useless scene and part of a half hour of the movie that probably didn't need to happen in the first place. But whatever. She had fans. You established her as a character. And again, I believe in sort of that rule of Chekhov's gun. If you're going to present it to me, I need to believe it matters. If you're going to introduce a character to me and the potentiality for romance or anything else, corollary, then you owe it to me to tie that thread up. You're making three movies here. This isn't 10 seasons of TV. This isn't Lost. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're J.J. Abrams, but you don't have to leave that many things untied. Uh-huh. How are you just going to act like this character doesn't exist? She went from being a massive, although unnecessary in my opinion, part of that movie in the second part of this trilogy to, she was, I forget what the screen time was, but it was like, I mean, it was measurable in seconds or minutes. He just erased her and everything. She just wasn't there.
It was kind of like what they did with Solo with, I can't remember the woman's name who died on a train track. It was like, you made
this.
It was like, it's kind of like sometimes they go with these emotional, they kind of pull on your heartstrings, and that doesn't really work anymore. Cause like the viewers now,
it's been done in this new one. I think we can be spoilery.
Spoiler alert, if you get over it.
I try to be kind about that.
It's been two months, so at this point,
there's a moment where this transport ship is taking off that ostensibly has Chewbacca on it, and Rey and Kylo kind of have a push pull moment with the ship, and anyway, the ship crashes and explodes, and they sell it hard as the death of Chewbacca. And you know, like I know, like any of us know, that anytime someone dies for real, they get an on-screen send-off. It's why you bought the death of Gamora in Infinity War.
Because
they showed the same reason I bought the Scarlett Johansson death. She didn't die off screen. People die off screen, always come back. It has to have the gravitas. All right, boom, right here in your face. This is what death looks like. We're gonna hold super long on it, so you know. And that's what this whole trilogy. You can't fall back on that anymore. You can't head fake a death. This isn't. Audiences are savvy, man. We're smart. You can't trick us with old tricks.
I think a lot of it has to come from like the Star Wars. It's like, all right, I've seen this. So, like you said, for example, when we didn't see Groot die, so we knew he was coming back. But like I said, we saw Gamora. So if like she's gonna come back, it's going to be a whole adventure. Like, and Scarlett Johansson coming back, it's like, okay, with the internet, like, okay, how many movies does he have left in her contract? We can go back and see, all right, she has one or two or whatever it is. So the movie now could be the beginning of something or the end of something. So we kind of get what's going on. It's kind of like the Chris Evans thing when they go, he's done as Captain America. I'm like, no, he said he was taking a break. There's a huge difference between two.
And I try to intentionally not read anything about the stuff I care about as it gets close to time for it to come out. I don't mind reading, you know, speculation a year or so in advance. But once it gets time to, like, people might know some stuff, I just try to put my fingers in my ears and go la 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 and walk into it. As like I legitimately, and when The Force Awakens came out, I did not know that Han Solo died.
Really?
I managed to avoid. Oh, I went internet dark for a week beforehand. I did not know. I knew that the rules of story dictated that someone was going to.
Yes.
That it would be Luke or Leia or Han. It would. I mean, it just stood to reason that was going to happen. I also fully expected Luke to be in the movie. So there were a lot of things that caught me off guard. It was a refreshingly fun watch for me, and I think part of that is why I'm not upset with this trilogy. I had a lot of fun with it. My expectations were high, and when the Force Awakens came out, I saw what everybody, so I, by nature of not knowing a single thing about it, I was able to watch it with fun eyes. I was able to watch, everything was new to me.
So what?
And then when I heard people complain about how it was so much like Star Wars, beat for beat, the new Episode 4. They go, beat for beat, it's exactly like Episode 4, and it's too nostalgic, and it's too this and that. And I said, you know what? I go, it is. I go, but we need that. I go, you're trying to bridge a gap between my generation that grew up on this and a new generation that you're counting on to be part of your new audience. I know the only way to do that is to give us a little bit of both. You gave us a brand new cast, diverse and awesome and cool, but you also gave me a lot of the old stuff, beats that felt familiar, planets that felt familiar, characters who felt familiar. You gave me all of that. You got all of us. And then I said, if you're going to do that, when you put out the second film, you have to go so far the other door. You have to take us places we've never thought of going. I don't care about nostalgia. Show me this new universe. And that's exactly what Rian Johnson did. He made a film that was so different from anything we've ever seen in the Star Wars universe. And it was beautiful. And then people bitched about it being too different. So J.J. Abrams came back and goes, okay. Everybody's got an opinion. All right, let me make that movie. There was no plan for Palpatine to be the big baddie again. The rules of story say he should be. That's where this all began. It's where it should end.
Dude, he died in Robot Chicken. If you die in Robot Chicken, that should be the end of it.
Right? But that's sort of the thing. It's the you kind of have to bring the story back around. This can't be part of the Skywalker story and not end with this Palpatine as the bad guy. JJ went in and fixed the story the way it probably should have been told from the beginning. It just wasn't, so it looks weird and forced. This is what they should have been doing. It's the same way, you know, where everybody was talking about the end of Game of Thrones and what they thought was going to happen, and it's unquestionably there was going to be a Stark on the throne. That's where the story began. It's where the story ends. Those are the rules of storytelling. So Palpatine really should be circular. He was the first. I mean, he was the shadow behind all of it happening. He was the Phantom Menace. I mean, his hands were in this architecture from the beginning, the way they told the story. But they certainly were in the original trilogy, and you see him die. But to have him sort of, it makes sense to me. It just makes sense. It's rushed. I wish I'd had a moment or two to breathe in this last movie. it feels forced in places, but they showed the Sith lore. They did a lot of stuff I've been waiting to see on screen. So I'm thrilled with it.
So you bring up a good point. You bring up Game of Thrones, and I'm one of the few people who I started watching Game of Thrones, and within, we'll say, 5 minutes of seeing Prince Joffrey, I stopped. He was so bad and annoying that I just couldn't go. I couldn't go anymore. But again, it was there was a whole thing on my mental state and just like angry and whatever. But like I went back and watched. So I'm back on it now. So now that the show's over, I'm binging it, and it's an amazing show. And you bring up the whole thing with Palpatine and all that. And like you said, seeing it coming. But Game of Thrones is so good that even though I know Ned Stark's about to get his head cut off, seeing it, it's still, you're still emotionally invested in that. In the scene where the guy takes Arya Stark and keeps calling her boy. Oh, yeah. And it's like, you get it. But even though you know what's going on, it's so well done that you don't care, because it's so well done. You're like, I don't care that I know what's going on. It's kind of like the replay value with like your favorite song. Like, I'm pretty sure, like, you have, like, what's your favorite album of all time? You could listen to it a million times because it has great replay value to it.
It loops back to the conversation we were having about the Joker and Joaquin Phoenix, and that even knowing what's coming, it's still spectacular to watch. And it's the way George R. R. Martin writes, and that's the way the first three seasons, anyway, three or four, I forget when they, wherever the series took a turn away from the book. But it, those first seasons are paced the way the books are written, and it's just artfully displayed. Whether you know what's coming or not, It is just a fun thing to watch unfold. They do it. The cinematography is incredible. The acting is amazing, and they understand tension better than I think any TV show has in memorable history.
I'm Witcher just started. I'm glad they've only done one season of Watchmen, and I'm mad no one got the joke that you made. I'm still mad at that, because I was sitting there laughing my ass. I'm like, wait, we're not going to acknowledge what he just said? I'm like, all right, cool. I figured at least Rob Mungo would have, but like, you know, that's neither here nor there. But like the idea of something like, you know, is coming, it's like when you know that a show or a movie is like going somewhere, but the execution is so good, you're like, it doesn't really matter. So there's been, I'm pretty sure even with you, like you're like, you watch, like you just said, like with episodes, six through nine, like you knew these things were coming, but like you still enjoyed it.
There's something refreshing to me sometimes about a story like that, that I guess that I've kind of, in my own sort of way, gotten to the end of before they got to the end of it. And sometimes, man, when you're really confident in knowing where it's going, it's kind of refreshing. It takes the pressure of trying to guess where, because that's all we do when we watch anything of any sort of entertainment. We're constantly trying to guess where it's headed. If we're watching a mystery or a suspenseful whatever, we're trying to get there before. That's how we all watch The Sixth Sense, and some of us knew he was dead before others, but it's what we do. So sometimes taking that off of the table is kind of nice, where I'm like, you know what? I know how you got to wrap this up. I don't know how you're going to get there. So let me just sit back and enjoy knowing that this ship gets safely to the harbor, and let me just see how you get it there.
Yeah. So how do you feel about Kylo Ren? I know some people hate her, some people love her. How do you feel about her?
Well, Rey?
Right, not Kylo Ren. Yeah. Rey, sorry.
Yeah, I like her. I like her a lot. I don't feel like they fleshed out. I think they were too worried about doing a lot of things in this trilogy. and they didn't focus on making us care about the characters. I like her, but at no point in this trilogy was there ever a character where, like, if it just been taken out by a blaster to the head right in front of me, that I would have been like, oh. I mean, that might have been my whole at best, just a whimper of just apathy, not empathy. I didn't care about her or Finn or even Poe, who was, you know, I guess my surrogate Han Solo. Even him, BB-8, I loved. I loved some of the little side characters. BB-8 again, the same artistry that we got with R2. But I just didn't feel attached emotionally to anybody in the movie. And I don't know whose fault that is. I think it's writing. I think they're wonderful actors. Every one of them. So it's somewhere in the writing. And I think the writing became this push-pull sort of fight between Abrams and Johnson. And I think the character suffered because of it. So, no, I don't dislike her. I just don't care.
You kind of nothing her.
Yeah, and it's all of this sounds so horrible to say. As I'm telling you, I thoroughly enjoyed all three films.
Well,
it's hands down, they're bright and they're colorful and they're fast and they're fun. And even when they're slow, they're still fun. And I enjoy the parts I don't enjoy. It's Star Wars, man. It's I wish they would, after watching The Mandalorian, I wish they would just give the keys to Jon Favreau. But
okay, you know what, man? I gotta go. But God, I want to talk about The Mandalorian, man. And it's funny, everyone talks about like 50-year-old Yoda. But he was like a third thought to that, because I thought actually the story about everything that was going on was so great. I loved The Mandalorian. I loved everything. It was just so damn good.
The best thing they've done with the Star Wars universe since Return of the Jedi. I mean, it's hands down. I even mean Rogue One. It's such good fucking TV. It's perfect. It is perfect. And I'm pretty convinced that Yoda's a girl.
Oh shit. Word?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it is. And part of me hopes it is, just because the amount of people that I heard screaming about how there were no female characters in the Mandalorian up until like the fourth episode, and I'm like, oh, wouldn't it be great if the main character, like literally the second main character, was a girl the whole time? I think that would be hilarious.
So, two things. One, I'm going to give you a list of titles. I may or may not have stolen that from the Whiskey Brothers, but but I have a list. But I think the title may be Baby Yoda is a Girl with a bunch of exclamation points.
Give it to it, man. That's hands down. I think it's gonna come out. They're too ambiguous with it. It's been referred to, I think, as a male, but like once or twice. But for the most part, they're very careful about not referring to it either way. And it's what a cool pivot if it was.
Let me tell you, I've watched, and I'm very wary about the shows that I watch, because it's like I have between writing articles and, like, you know, podcasting and having a full-time job. It's like, I was like, I'm not watching anything that doesn't keep my attention. Like, The Mandalorian came out, I'm like, yeah, I need to watch that, like, now.
And it's so good, because almost nothing happens over the course of 10 episodes. It literally goes nowhere. It's so much about, it is such a, it's so Sergio Leone Western to begin with. Coupled with the message of just be here now, like you're watching this story, and the only thing that's happening in these episodes are these weird, very short vignettes. You know what I mean? Like the one where it's just him and the other bounty hunter going after that. I mean, it's just you're watching one sort of afternoon.
But you know what's funny about that is, though, is like while there's nothing going on, there's also so much going on. Like you're a writer, and I'm pretty sure you're watching all this stuff going on, and you're pitching yourself. You're picturing yourself writing High Grass.
To write a scene, like, I think my favorite Star Wars moment ever is the conversation between those two scout troopers in the last episode of Mandalorian, where they're just out there and they've got the baby Yoda and they're sort of taking... That is the funniest conversation. And it was the realest... for five, however long that scene was, and my guess is probably 5 to 7 minutes. It had some legs to it. For however long that scene was, they killed a 10% of the episode with this really witty, it was just witty banter on the surface. But the reality was, it was establishing the character, Moff Gideon's character, it was doing so much while nothing was happening. And that's the magic. That's why I say give Favreau the keys, man. Let him drive. I trust him. Drunk. He can drive drunk.
Here at the Old Man Wade Show, we don't encourage driving drunk. Make sure that you take an Uber who isn't paying us, or maybe a Lyft. If you want to sponsor a... But yeah, fuck it. But when it was funny...
Unless you're John Favreau in the car Star Wars and then drive that bitch drunk.
But you know what's funny about it is? But even with something as simple as, like, them just having a conversation. Like, so I've had this debate with my best friend about who's the cutest character ever. And he goes, Baby Yoda. I go, fuck you. It's fucking, it's Gizmo. And he goes, yeah... And he goes, yeah, well, Gizmo's useless and Yoda and Baby Yoda is. I'm like, okay, you win that. But even watching the two of them, like, and it's like he hit the kid, and me and my wife are watching it, and she's fine. And I'm like, did he just hit Baby Yoda? and she's calm and cool. And I'm like, you can't hit Baby Yoda. You can't do that. Like, what are you doing hitting Baby Yoda? But, like, you become so invested in these characters.
And they've done it with such minimalism. And that's my favorite part. That is the most minimalist show. It is stripped everything down to the ability to move a story forward in just dialogue, and not just the story that you're watching, but the other parts around it with just lines of dialogue. It's their that you care that much about this character that hasn't said a word. Nothing. You've been fooled by puppetry. It's that to me is good filmmaking. They're just, they know how to, I mean, they're manipulating our emotions the way they intend to.
And, oh God, I can't believe I'm about to make this correlation, but it's kind of like Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Second time that's come up today. Wow.
I'm a writer. I have some stuff going on. But for me, when I was watching it as a kid, like, Who Framed Roger Rabbit was, like, the epitome of storytelling to me. And, like, the detectives and the war stuff like that. But it's, like, Roger is this, like, idiot character, but he has so much that he's so important to all this. And then you find, and then, like, Christopher Lloyd's character, and then, like, everything with the weasels. And then you grow up and you watch it later on, you're like... Oh my God, there's so much more to the weasels. There's so much more to Christopher Lloyd. There's so much more to all these characters. And you're like, holy fuck. And then it's like, and you're watching The Mandalorian, and then you're getting like this random like episode with Bill Burr, and you're like, okay, you guys just threw Bill Burr in there for shits and giggles.
God, he was so good.
Yes.
He was so good.
And it's like, holy fuck. Like, even like something as simple as Bill Burr, it made sense. So it's like everyone who came into this was great. And I'm going to fuck this guy's name up, but the guy who did Thor Ragnarok, who did the last episode of Mandalorian, again.
Oh, Tahiti.
But, like, everything that he did in that episode, that final episode, built up everything that was happening for the next season.
Again, there were no wasted movements throughout the other episodes.
Yeah.
You got to the end and you felt like everything it asked you to pay attention to, it rewarded you for paying attention to. Yeah. And that's, I think that, and that's ultimately what my problem is with this last Star Wars trilogy, is that they betrayed that trust. And I think that's a wonderful way for me to put a cap on all of this. That's what they did. J.J. Abrams built certain expectations, and then Rian Johnson sort of said, fuck that, and he sort of made his own film. And I appreciated that, but he built other expectations. And then J.J. Abrams came back and went, you know what? We're not going to close off any of those either. It was so flagrantly betraying my trust as an audience. I trust that if you show me this, it's going to pay off. And then they just didn't do that. And that's, Mandalorian does the exact opposite of that.
I always tell people, like, for me, it's like, for me, the perfect movie is V for Vendetta. There are no wasted moments. Nothing was wasted. Everything that happened kind of comes back at the end. And no matter how many times I see the end of that movie where the newscaster takes his hood off, even though he's dead, and then the woman who was helping V through his time in the room 5, it was like, I still get emotional to it because they build up to this whole thing. And I think that's the biggest part of Mandalorian is, as you said, there are no wasted moments, there are no wasted issues, there are no wasted, like, lines.
Even the part that it's, you know, again, the rules of story, every scene, everything has to either move, it has to move the story forward, and so it has to answer a question, it has to serve a purpose. You don't bring characters in if they're not contributing to the scene. Everything is really stripped down to its essence, and that's what The Mandalorian embodies to me. It's even the stuff that seems trivial or seems pointless, like a conversation between two scout troopers, is really laying this groundwork in such a unique way that you don't have to show it visibly in that, look, there's a bear, and then they show a bear kind of storytelling. We see too much of that. You know, is here's my story. It's cooler when you can hear that story come out in a different kind of way through a cool, really entertaining to watch conversation. It's just damn good storytelling.
Shit. You know what's funny is that there's so many things. So there's so many more things I want to ask you, but I've been up for now. I've been up for 20. No. Added up for 32 hours, so I need to take my ass to bed.
Brother, get off the show.
No.
We'll do this again. We've done it before. We'll do it again.
But before we
down to talk, this kind of stuff.
Before we go, tell everyone, one, where they can find you, your Instagram, the Facebook, the podcast. Tell everyone where they can find you.
Yeah, at Slade Ham. It's easy to. It's SladeHam. I do a really cool newsletter that comes out twice a month. You can sign up for it at sladeham.com. But it's really cool, kind of motivational. Just it's the, sort of the world I see, and if I can help other people, you know, kind of get out of their comfort zones a little bit, I try to. I do these video logs when I'm traveling, and all of that sort of comes out there, and it's a pretty cool place to hang if you're looking for a kick in the ass. So, and then of course the Whiskey Brothers. It's a little podcast I do.
A little podcast you do. Really humble. Really humble of you, little podcast. If you're not easily offended, you should probably cut this shit the fuck off. But yeah, like the Whiskey Brothers is like, I got my boy Fletcher who he heard you on the first episode and immediately jumped on, and it was funny because I had some back episodes. I sent him a couple, and then he sent me a picture of Dave Chappelle, like, you know, the Tyrone Biggums. He goes, hey, man, you got any more of them backlogs? but he likes the show. Like, he's officially put you in, like, so when we talk about podcasts, he goes, oh, yeah, listen, he'll go Joe Rogan, the Whiskey Brothers, and then I'll mention some other stuff because he loves the show. Because
that's awesome.
Because realistically, it's like you guys are raw, you're unfiltered, and honestly, if you are offended by something, do not fucking listen, because you'll hear some shit that you don't want to fucking hear. But
it's interesting. It's so funny because it's not done to be offensive. We have this weird sort of, it's a writer's room, and we've got this unspoken agreement that nothing you say in that room, like, you're held accountable for. And we know that. We know that amongst each other. And the fact that it's being broadcast, you know, has its own set of repercussions. But it's the, when people are offended by it, you're like, look, man, this is just, it's the same thought process you go through every fucking day. We're just having it out loud. And that's the funniest part to me, is we all, our brains run the same routes. We all have the same thoughts. We're just actually vocalizing the thought process. And that's what's fun for me.
Good sir, I'd like to tell you that I'm a good Christian man. I would never say any of those things like shit, fuck, bitch, and all those other fucking words that you say. I would never say those fucking words ever, ever, ever. But
then you should probably listen to something else, sir.
But
that's advice I can give you. That's you make your choices, and I'm gonna have a good time with my life.
Yeah, but what's funny about it is I love the fact that is it Outlaw Dave?
Uh-huh.
And I love the fact that he goes, if you're offended, this will do it. And I love the fact that you guys have always been really honest about it. It's like, hey, look, this is what you're going to listen to. This is what's going to happen. And if you are easily offended, cut it the fuck off right now.
Well, you have to. At this day and age anymore, and I'm not an apologist about anything, but I do believe in, you know what? There was a sign on the door. You got shot in the living room. There was a sign on the door, this is Texas. I don't know what else to tell you. it's I don't know what you thought the outcome was going to be. You listened your way through an intro that told you people were probably going to say something that you might disagree with. And you walked right on in, looked around, poured yourself a cup of tea, and then bitched that there wasn't sugar. Like, it's just... What is wrong with you?
So let me tell you. So I remember the first comedy show that I went to live, and I just happened to work in a place where I could get a hookup, and they go, we'll put you right on stage. I went, yeah, let's not put me right on stage. Can you put me somewhere on the left or the right? Like, I don't want to be anywhere near the fucking stage because I'm going to drink. But again, like, you kind of have to know who and what you are when you're drinking. Like, if I'm in a good mood, I am a loud, boisterous, clapping, fucking Patrick from SpongeBob kind of guy. If I'm angry, then it's like, yeah, I shouldn't do this. I'm like, so yeah, put me over to the side where if the bouncer kicks me out, then there won't be a scene.
Right.
But again, but as you said before, know the type of person you are, but there's also a lot of self-awareness that goes in it, and I'm not getting to, this isn't fucking Ricky Lake, it'll be Ricky Lake later on, when we talk about this shit, but this is the nerd shit, this is all this stuff. Don't forget to visit Slateham, Instagram, Twitter, he responds, he's funny as hell, but a warning, he's honest, so if you come at Slateham with some nonsense, just know, you will be, responded to with the same energy that you are brought. He won't just go, if you say hello, he won't go, fuck you, you C-word. But if you call him and you call him out and you do some dumb shit, that same energy will be repercussed. So, but this has been the Old Man Wade Show. I want to thank Slade for coming on again. It's funny. Every time we do this, and I want to go, fuck, I want to talk about Spawn. I want to talk about Deadpool. I want to talk about... You know what's funny? Because part of me wants to send you a bunch of comic, because I'm kind of purging myself of comic books. And I go, fuck, I'm going to send this stuff to him so he can understand where I'm coming from. But yeah, that's been the end of the show. This has been the Old Man Wade Show. I normally have something funny to say, but in spirit of Whiskey Brothers, fuck off?
That'll work. Get your ass to bed.
Damn it, Wade!